Good morning, New Mexico, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company on Cordova Road and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. We are podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can listen to the show whenever you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services, and you can subscribe to the show on iTunes. Later on in the program, we're going to be speaking with our foreign correspondent, Bill Burke White. Right now, I would like to welcome, joining us here in the cafe, William Underwood and Colt Brown. They are with Locals Care. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
It's good to be here.
Good morning, Mary Charlotte.
Great to have you. So Locals Care is a Santa Fe-based organization that brings together locally owned businesses, merchants, nonprofit organizations, and shoppers. What's it all about? How does it work?
Well, the biggest thing Locals Care does is it connects people to businesses that want to donate money to their nonprofit. So if you're a shopper and you want to help give over the holiday season or any time during the year to a nonprofit that's important to you, we give you an avenue of shopping at a local merchant, and that merchant will donate a portion of your purchase back to that nonprofit. So as a shopper, nothing extra comes out of your pocket.
And so you have, how do you decide what is a locally owned business?
We do locally owned and operated here in Santa Fe or an adjoining county. Can't be a publicly traded company.
And can't be a franchise.
That's right.
And so these merchants, these locally owned businesses, of which there are many, and we'll talk about that, sign up to be part of the Locals Care program. And what do they post, a little card in their window?
Well, we do put a poster in their window. They have a big sticker. They usually have a sign by the register. You can find them online at locals-care.com to see which businesses are participating and which nonprofits are participating. We send out emails. We use direct mail. We advertise in the newspaper. Boy, we put their information out there in a lot of different ways so that shoppers know where to go.
So what happens if I go to a locally owned bookstore, let's say, that is part of the Locals Care program? I spend $100. What happens to my $100? Where does it go?
Well, if you go to, say, Collected Works, which is a locally owned bookstore.
A fine locally owned bookstore.
It is. And we love
one of several.
We love the Collected Works bookstore. They've been a part of the program for a long time. And if you spend $100 there, they donate $2 of your purchase to the nonprofit you chose.
So let's say I choose, just as a random example, KSFR.
KSFR, which you can choose in the Locals Care program. $2 out of your $100 purchase goes directly to KSFR. There's no handling fees. There's no charges. It gets directly contributed to KSFR. And $2 goes back to you as a shopper in the form of cash that you can then spend at another locally owned merchant.
So in other words, it accumulates. So every time I spend, you know, $20 here, $5 there, whatever, at a certain point I can say, hey, I want my cash back.
You absolutely can.
But you don't. It doesn't come right back to you at that moment.
Nope. It comes back in $10 chunks.
Okay.
So every time you earn $10 to spend, we put $10 available on your card.
So I've got $2 going to KSFR. I've got $2 eventually coming back to me.
Yep. There's another portion that the merchant pays that goes into the marketing and the fund to actually make the program run. It's part of their advertising costs.
That goes back to Locals Care.
Yep.
Now, when you say that's part of their advertising cost, Locals Care essentially is providing a service to the merchants. That is it advertising? Would you call it advertising?
I'd absolutely call it advertising, and a service is an excellent way to put it. I mean, merchants obviously wouldn't want to get involved if they were just giving away money, because they could donate directly to the nonprofit if that's what they wanted to do. No, they get involved because they want to appeal to these shoppers who buying local and supporting local nonprofits is important to. And when it's key on those shoppers' minds, they think, well, I'm going to go someplace that supports the same things I support. I want to go someplace that supports my nonprofit or that helps me do that. So these merchants, these businesses get involved because they want to talk directly to an audience that cares about buying local and cares about shopping at nonprofit.
Now, one of the things that you and I have talked about off the air at other times is the extent to which it is harder and harder for any business to reach the customers it wants to reach.
Oh, wow. That is so true today. In years gone by, we have a generational marketing. Lots of people are familiar with that, talking to the baby boomers, talking to the Gen Xers, all of those types of things. And those groups have become so small and fragmented now that reaching a marketing group is hard. Not many people just read the newspaper or just look online. Now we have hundreds of magazines and radio and television.
So it's fragmented because of the many different media that we baby boomers and Gen Xers and Gen Yers read?
That's one of the big things. There are so many different ways that you can segment your interest.
So, in other words, so I go online and I read, you know, Salon.com, and then I read the Santa Fe Reporter, and then I read Bust Magazine.
Yeah.
And you, as a sleeping bag manufacturer, say, how am I going to sell a sleeping bag to Mary Charlotte?
Sure. 20 years ago, Mary Charlotte, you wouldn't have had all those places you could go for that information. You went to the newspaper and you went to your magazine. Aside from that, there wasn't anywhere else to go. Now, you have hundreds of different things you can go to every single day to get the information you want. So your sleeping bag manufacturer or your local bookstore looks at it and says, well, how do I find somebody that's interested in shopping locally and interested in coming to a local bookstore? Because that's really what they want to do.
And so how do they actually reach, what is the mechanism by which they do reach Santa Fans?
You can reach Santa Fans by a lot of different ways. Locals Care is just one of them. We offer a niche group of people that their prime interest, or one of their prime interests, is either supporting a nonprofit or buying local. They've self-enrolled. They say, I want to be a part of this program. I really like what this program stands for. And they become a part of the Locals Care program, and they know we're going to tell them, you should go shop at this merchant. He's locally owned and operated. He'll give to your nonprofit.
William Underwood, you've been very quiet. One of the things that is very important about this program is keeping money in the economy, in the local economy. So I go to Collected Works, I spend $100, or I go to any locally owned shop or whatever, I spend $100. What happens to that money versus if I go to a big box store and spend the same amount?
Sure. Well, when you spend $100 at a local merchant, about $45 recirculates within the local economy. When you spend that same $100 at a chain merchant, it goes out of the community. At midnight.
$100 of it?
No, excuse me. It only recirculates into $12 in the economy. So what happens is money at the end of the day gets ACH'd out of the community.
ACH.
Which is electronically cleared through banks. And so every day you're spending money at a chain. Well, at midnight, that money leaves the community. It's gone back to corporate headquarters, and it's draining money out of the economy. Now,
that says a lot about how little money is spent on labor.
Well, no, it's actually quite complicated, and economists argue over the multipliers, but what they agree on is the difference between the multipliers. So basically the difference between them is around $30 to $32 for every 100, which is a huge number. When we started Locals Care, we started talking back in 2005. At that point, there was $100 million a month spent on accommodations, retail, and food. And if you just think about all of that was chain, which of course it isn't, then it would only recirculate to $12 million in our economy. But if it was all local, it would recirculate to $45
million. So $100 million a month is spent in Santa Fe.
That's when we started the program, those are the statistics.
That's a lot of money.
That was several years ago.
Yeah, and if you look at that, that's $35 million a month that's up for grabs, whether if it was all local or all chain. Of course, it's not going to be 100%, but it's been sliding. The local market share keeps losing, and that keeps draining our economy. When we shop local, it keeps that money back in the economy, and eventually it will hit that chain, and eventually it will leak out. But until then, it just keeps going back and forth across the street. Local merchants use local graphic artists. They use local accountants. A lot of those services are done back at chain headquarters, and so you don't get those services in the economy. So it's a huge thing at the macro level, and it's also a huge thing on the micro level. Local merchants, they're spending money on advertising. They'll spend it on what's effective. If customers say, hey, part of your marketing, do this, give money to my nonprofit, as long as customers respond to that, merchants are very happy to do it. But in order to be sustainable, it has to grow their business. Otherwise, then, you know, it's not, it gets expensive.
Because they're losing $6 on the 100.
Well, yes and no.
That's always an interesting way to look at it. Are they losing? What they're doing is they're investing $6 on 100 to get a specific return out of it. And that's what you do when you go buy your advertising. If you spend $1,000 on your reporter ad this week, you're going to hope that you get $10,000 or $20,000 back. You can ask all your merchants and see how many think they get that back. Different people have different opinions. With Locals Care, we actually know when somebody spends $100 with a Locals Care merchant, or excuse me, when a merchant spends $100 with Local Care, we can tell them that over $1,500 was spent back in their store.
So you're collecting, tell us more about the data that you're collecting and how it's used.
It's all aggregated. There's no personal information. We don't have any information on what people are buying specifically, and we don't really
share. Well, that's a good thing. You don't know what books I'm buying.
No, and we don't want to know what books people are buying, but it's just, you know, for them, they can say, here's the total sales in your store, and they can track it. Now, let's give a brief idea of what it means that it's marketing. If you have a $100 customer and they come in more frequently because of the program and they end up spending $120, you got a 20% return there.
Right.
And also, if they normally spend $100, let's say, if their average ticket's $100, and now they spend $120 because they're spending more per visit, that also makes them a $120 customer. Now you do both at the same time. You take a $100 customer and a $140 customer. They can afford to give the money to the nonprofits if they're getting those kinds of returns, and they are. So it becomes very cost-effective for them. It's not the only type of marketing. It's just for the people who have self-enrolled. It's just for the people who say, these are the two things that are important to me, local or nonprofits.
So there are probably many people who are listening who are in favor of local business and who have their favorite nonprofit, especially KSFR, but others as well, who probably have never heard of the program. I mean, how do you get the word out there?
Boy, getting the word out there is the hardest. We have time we spend at the farmers market. We do displays at local merchants. We have local merchants that enroll people. We have people that actually go out to restaurants and actively enroll people while they're standing in line and waiting to go eat that evening. But in general, it's word of mouth. We have almost 15,000 people who have signed up for a card, which about half of them are probably active regularly in the program. They've decided, I like it, and this is something I want to do.
Right.
So they use their card on a reasonably regular basis. We don't ask people to use it all the time. Really what we're asking people to do is say, can you move one purchase a week, even if it's just your cup of coffee?
Right.
And you're going to go out, can you make one purchase that you would have made at a chain store at a local merchant?
Well, this number that you mentioned a moment ago, that $100 million a month changes hands in Santa Fe, and if that goes into local hands, 35 million more of that actually stays in local circulation. What does that do for regular citizens?
It does a ton.
Well, you know, one of the basic premises is we're all in this together. And I think in this new economy, we're seeing that. Our view is that people are spending more money with local merchants. There's an opportunity that you want to do business with people you know. And that money basically recirculates. So people always think about when they're spending money at a merchant. But what they don't realize is that money comes straight out of the merchant and is spent at your business or the place that you work. So it's actually in your own self-interest to keep your business strong, and the way to do that is to keep the money in the economy. So let's say there's a famous hotel and they're just getting painted downtown and they have an Albuquerque painter. And you're thinking, well, gosh, that would be great for a Santa Fe painter to do that, because then you keep the money and the Santa Fe person is probably going to spend the money at Santa Fe restaurants, Santa Fe shops, and the Albuquerque person isn't. Now, Albuquerque, Santa Fe, that's still in the region. So that's not really the same as a chain store going out, but it is good for us individually when we keep local merchants strong. It keeps the money in our economy. It keeps higher tax revenue, more money for our parks and our services like police. And it's better for all of us because the money's not leaking out. Once it's gone, it's gone. You have to attract it back in, or you have to spend the dollars that are recirculating. And that's it. That's how you get money in your economy, those two ways.
You know, we recently had REI join the Santa Fe community. REI is a great company. It does a lot of good things. Let me say that right up front. But in Locals Care, we have a good solid 5 merchants that are going to be solidly impacted by that. And they've all done surveys and worked with their customers to see how much they're going to be impacted by that. And we've talked with them about it. And the bulk of their grade A, really good customers have said, you know, I probably won't buy much at REI, but I may spend $100 there a year. If we take all 5 of our merchants, who probably have 20,000 solid customers between them, and we say that each of those 20,000 solid customers is going to go spend $100 at REI versus in our local economy, that takes a significant chunk.
$2 million that's coming out of those local merchants. Now, how do they replace that, number one? And number two, when that recirculates in the economy, you know, you're losing tax revenue. You're losing the money that's going to those local employees that are coming back, and you're losing the profits to the owners.
That's a huge thing. Your local employee, that's $2 million that directly didn't go back into paying their staff this year.
It's interesting because as you're talking, one thing that I'm realizing is that we have quite a number of wonderful local businesses who do contribute to KSFR. So when you support, for example, Collected Works, the owners of that store actually will make a contribution to this station or underwrite this station, which is a lot less likely that a chain store will do. And that probably goes for a lot of the other nonprofits in town.
Well, there's also another point is there are cities all over this country who are just brokenhearted over the fact that their main streets are abandoned. That strip malls have come in and they've become Strip Mall USA. Once you pull into the lot and you see whatever they are, whatever those chain stores are, you could be anywhere. There's nothing unique. And as a tourist town and as a town with so much history, we are very lucky to have so many amazing and remarkable local merchants. But if we don't protect them and we don't care for them and we don't take the time to do our shopping, especially this year at this holiday, make a point and say, I don't know what I'm going to get, but I'm going to go look at a local merchant till I find something. That's how you keep them here and keep them in business and make sure that you don't turn into Strip Mall USA.
We're talking to Locals Care, who can be found on the web at locals-care.com, which is where people can sign up for that. So this is a particularly important time to be talking about this because it's Christmas season.
Yes, it is.
And you know, all three of us met earlier, and I was trying to sort of think of the economics of it. So let's say in a chain store, you might save 20% on an item, but then the money goes out of the economy. So in terms of looking at savings in a bigger picture, it's tricky to compute.
Let me address that for a second. You know, at some chain stores, you might save 20% on an item, but it depends on the item you're buying too. What you can
get might be of lower quality.
It might be of lower quality. It's probably not, you know, as everybody likes to say, apples to apples.
Yeah, I think it's generally regarded as a myth. When you like start looking at a lot of things closely, you're often surprised that local merchants are not more expensive, even though it's a commonly held belief.
Now, there are, you know, Black Friday sales, things like that. The big chain stores are going to have better deals on. They just are. And they're always going to have loss leaders. But for a bulk of the product, if you want a really good quality product, and you go see a local merchant, you're going to usually find a better selection of quality product, and you're going to find a better product. If you're just going out to buy a folding chair, Walmart's probably going to beat your local merchant price every day.
And yet, when you take the whole picture together, if you shift some of your purchases from the Walmart to the local store, you are benefiting yourself even in a way that doesn't come back to you right away.
You're benefiting yourself because you do get points back, a percentage back. You're benefiting your nonprofit, which, let me tell you, in this economy is critical because they are really facing a tough economic environment.
As we are, I have to say, at the radio station.
Absolutely. I mean, this is one thing that people haven't talked enough about is, you know, the merchants are really struggling, but the nonprofits as well are really struggling. And to make a sustainable economy, I think it's important that every time a dollar changes hands, a nonprofit is participating. And all that has to happen is consumers say, that's a better way, and then everything will go that way. Everybody will be donating to nonprofits, and nonprofits will be getting their money, not having to earn it, not having to, you know, be an economic engine. They're not economic engines. They're providing critical services in our community. Let's give them a dollar out of the economic activity in the community automatically so they can do their job, but let's also get the nonprofits to support our local merchants.
So you've been running this program for several years now. How do you measure your success? How do you measure how you're doing so far?
Well, so far we've raised about $105,000 for nonprofits, which we're really happy about. And we've had a lot of support from the city of Santa Fe, from Los Alamos National Bank has been amazing, helping us solve a lot of technology issues. Century Bank helped us get it going. And, you know, the benefits of local banking are great. People should really rethink why they aren't banking local. Because that also keeps your money in the economy.
Right.
They make most of the loans to merchants that are under $250,000. And large national banks don't do that. And plus, large national banks ship their money out of the community, and local banks keep their money working to develop the community. So really encourage everybody to really think about why aren't they banking local or working it with a credit union. So we've had a lot of support. We've also done over $5 million in sales at local merchants. So that's cardholders. Remember, most of these people were signed up by merchants. That's cardholders walking in, pulling out their card, saying, I'm supporting a nonprofit and I'm supporting you. And they've done that for over 5 million sales. So we actually have the best statistics of any program in the country that's ever been done like this.
Now, are there programs all over the United States of this nature?
Boy, I'd say all over is a real
Not
stretch
quite.
Of it. There's a couple other programs that have tried it in different places. Most of them have failed. There are a couple other programs that are similar that are actively working on becoming something. There's one in California. There's one in Colorado. But there's none that are quite as unique or as directly beneficial to the nonprofits and to the local merchants as Locals Care is.
So, yay Santa Fe.
Yay. We started off with a focus of how can we make a program for merchants. A lot of the people have started off, how can they make a program for cardholders? What they ended up doing is not getting either. And we think we always stay focused on the merchant because we want to help the merchant survive. And this is a great way. And it's up to the cardholder. If cardholders say, I'm spending my money in this way, to make sustainable community, it's sustainable capital, then it works. And merchants are happy, nonprofits are happy, cardholders are happy.
So potential cardholders, merchants, and nonprofits can go to locals-care.com to find out more. Anything that you want to let people know before we go?
If you want to get a Locals Care card, you can go to any Locals Care merchant. They usually have a poster on the door. It's got a pretty colored coffee cup on it. It's got a picture of a Locals Care card. And they will gladly give you a card right there that day.
Isn't the Santa Fe Baking Company one of those?
The Santa Fe Baking Company is one of those merchants.
They've been a huge supporter from the beginning, and people love to come here and use their card. Also, if you're a nonprofit, you can go to our website. There's a button you can press, and you can get it's free to enroll. And every penny that a nonprofit earns, we give them every penny. We pay all the costs for the program. And if you're a merchant and you're interested and you want to grow your business in these difficult times and market to our 15,000 people, you can go to the website or you can just give us a call.
To give you an example, the Santa Fe Baking Company sees over 1,300 cards a month. So people really do care and bring it on and use it.
So if I could do math quickly, I could figure out how much of that money would be going to the various nonprofits. But, it's a wonderful program, and we want to thank you both so much for being on, William Underwood and Colt Brown of Locals Care. Thanks for being on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte. We love your show.
Thank you. We're going to take a break right now. We'll be right back. Stay tuned to KSFR. I'd like now to welcome Bill Burke White. He is professor of international law at the University of Pennsylvania, and he is our regular foreign correspondent. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Hi, Mary Charlotte. It's great to be with you again.
Great to have you back. So one of the things that I think it's important for us to talk about at this point is we know that when the American economy has a downturn, it affects the rest of the world economically. World stock markets go down, there's turmoil. But one thing that we haven't really talked about that much is how this affects foreign policy. And I thought maybe you could share some of your thoughts about that with us.
Well, Mary Charlotte, I think it's a very important question and one that, for perhaps obvious reasons, has been overlooked as we focused on how to fix the mortgage crisis and then the credit crisis, and every day it seems to be a different financial crisis. But what does it really mean for foreign policy? And it, in fact, has huge ramifications for U.S. foreign policy, but also for sort of the state of the world as we look out at it. And we can break it down into a lot of different areas. But let's start maybe first by looking at what it means for other countries and then bring it home to what it means for the United States. I think that the change in the world economy obviously has hit home hard for many of your listeners and others who are facing, you know, job layoffs or wage cuts. But it may have even worse implications in other countries. Take, for example, China, which is one of the most important countries out there today. China is far less stable than we are, and while individuals will suffer, America will probably survive as we know it. But China could be a different story. For much of the last 10 or 15 years, the Chinese government has built their legitimacy. Remember, China's not a democracy, and it has 1.5 billion people, and it relies on a kind of tacit bargain, you might say, with its population, that the government will provide an ever-rising standard of living, and that people have sort of bought into limited freedoms and not being directly involved in the political space in exchange for essentially every year getting better off. And as the world economy slows down, that means a lot less buying of consumer goods, and most of those goods come from China. And so the Chinese economy has been threatened with an even more severe collapse in some ways than our economy. And if the Chinese government cannot continue to provide an ever-rising standard of living for its own people, that tacit bargain starts to break down. And you could well see a situation in China where the government has much less ability to achieve its objectives than it does today, where there is more uprising, where there is more complaint, where there's a greater chance of riots or some kind of civil unrest than you see today. And in a worst-case scenario, you could even see that escalating to a point where it threatens the legitimacy and the very ability of the Chinese government to continue as we know it. Now, of course, some people might say, well, it's a communist dictatorship anyway. Why do we care? Well, I'll tell you, we're a lot better off with a stable Chinese government and one we can do business with than one that's worried about its own political future, or especially than one that leads to collapse and some kind of disorder or lack of governance in China. And if the Chinese government is unable to sort of hold itself together based on this vision of economic improvement, it might turn to other sources of legitimacy, the leading one of them being nationalism, the idea that the Han Chinese, the dominant minority, might start to move in nationalistic ways against other groups, say the Taiwanese or the Tibetans or the Uyghurs, the Islamic groups in parts of China, and you could see real civil chaos and unrest in China. And so that kind of situation could be very dangerous and could well be the result of a continued global economic slowdown.
In a situation like China, where you talk about it's a less stable country, it's a huge country, what happens when instability sets in? What happens when the economy really falters? People's lifestyle or standard of living starts to go down. I mean, we've seen many, many examples in the history of China of brutal suppression when people start to rise up or when they complain about anything at all.
Yeah, I mean, if you think back to 1991 in Tiananmen Square, the last major uprising in at least the central parts of China led to a brutal crackdown by the Chinese government. Thankfully, they have not taken that approach to the more minor uprisings that they have seen in places like Beijing, though what happened in Tibet last year was very troubling when the government did crack down. You could see a situation in which the Chinese government felt that its only solution was the use of military force against its own people. God willing, we won't see that happen. But if they, you know, first are unable to deliver economically, and second are unable to use nationalism to hold the state together, you could well see a more brutal crackdown. And even in the past few days, I'm not sure it's related to the economy, but in the run-up to the 60th anniversary of the Universal Declaration on Human Rights, there have been new arrests in China. So you could see the government turn against its own people, though hopefully they will be wise enough to avoid that approach.
As anybody who has gone shopping lately knows, a lot of products that we have in the United States are made in China, and that their economy of export is huge. Do they also have... do they use their own products? I mean, in other words, is a large part of China's economy based on selling stuff to themselves, to the Chinese?
Not traditionally. I mean, China's economic boom has been largely driven by exports. More recently, particularly if you go to Beijing or Shanghai, you see lots of consumerism. The difference is, of course, if you go out to the countryside, the peasants have not been a consumer economy. And one of the things the Chinese government has sought to do recently is to encourage some of those Chinese peasants to start spending rather than saving. They have saved a great deal of money, and that savings has in many ways financed the American credit boom of the last 10 years. But the Chinese are now trying to convince their people, and particularly those outside of the big urban centers, that it's time to start spending some of that money and shifting from being a dominantly export-driven economy to one that is satisfying a domestic consumer demand, because there's plenty of people and plenty of saved capital. But at least with some of the interesting news reports we've seen, it's just not in the mentality of the Chinese peasantry to go buy fancy television sets or fancy clothes. And so there may have to be a kind of broader shift in the way China is thinking about itself. And its own, you know, Chinese people are thinking about what they do with their money.
It is odd to think of Chinese peasants financing the American credit situation.
And they certainly have. I mean, the Chinese peasants have been saving, you know, hundreds or thousands of dollars. But when you multiply that by a billion people, suddenly you have quite a savings pool. And the Chinese have used those funds to buy, for example, U.S. dollars or American dollar-denominated securities. So they hold a vast amount of these U.S. dollars. The problem for the Chinese is they can't sell them because they own so many that if they were to sell their U.S. dollar holdings, it would drive the value of the U.S. dollar down, and with it, the value of China's holdings. Now, this is good for the United States in that it means that China can't sort of sell out the U.S. dollar to finance an economic crisis, but it means that China, despite having all of this savings, is not in a position to be able to sell it to continue financing the government. They can sell little bits, but they certainly can't engage in a mass sell-off that would affect the broader value of the dollar.
So, a new presidency, which we're about to have, starting on the 20th of January, looking at economic policy, looking at foreign policy toward China, what do they need to be cognizant of? What do they need to think about?
Well, I think two things. First of all, they need to really engage China like they need to engage the rest of the world and sort of signal a new American era of diplomacy. But they also have to be careful not to put too much pressure on China. And it's not just China. If you look around the world, a number of countries, ranging from China to Russia that we might talk about, even to countries in Europe like Greece that has faced massive riots in the past few days based on a police shooting of a teenager, are all in more precarious positions than they have been, which means that while the Obama administration will ask other governments to do more of the global burden of foreign aid and development and political work than the Bush administration was able to because Bush alienated the rest of the world, they can't push too far. Because if the Chinese say, hey, we really can't do that because we just don't have the power, it may not just be a bargaining strategy. The Chinese really may mean that they don't believe they have the political power vis-a-vis their own people to do some of the things that we might ask them to do that could be either economically painful. For example, one of the things we have constantly been pressing the Chinese to do is to devalue the yuan, their own currency, and to do this in a way of making the U.S. trade budget go down and bring the yuan more into parity with other currencies. The Chinese may not be able to do that because it could have negative effects on their own economy that they simply cannot withstand. So there may be a sense that we need to not ask as much of some governments as we might want to as we go forward.
We're talking to our foreign correspondent, Bill Burke White. Let's talk about Russia once again. How stable is Russia at this moment in the world economic climate?
Well, on one hand, we see President Medvedev and Prime Minister slash former President, perhaps future President Putin, appearing on national television looking as strong as ever and engaging in wars in Georgia. But the economic fundamentals in Russia and many other oil exporting states are very precarious. just 3 or 4 months ago, oil was approaching $150 a barrel. Today, it is less than half of that. It's in the $50 to $60 range. And many of those governments base their budgets on oil priced somewhere around $100. And suddenly, those governments are unable to meet their budget projections, which means that they're not able to do many of the things they had planned to do. And in Russia, there was a tacit agreement as well, slightly different than the one in China. This was an agreement between the oligarchs, the big businessmen, and the Kremlin. And it was an agreement where the Kremlin would continue to support the oligarchs' business dealings, and the oligarchs would stay out of the way of politics and let Putin run the country. When the global economy started to collapse, the oligarchs were hit very, very hard because most of their wealth was tied up in natural resources, energy supplies and other kinds of resources coming out of Russia. And there was an across-the-board slump in natural resource prices recently. So many of those companies have started to either go bankrupt or like our auto industry, turn to the Russian government for support. And the Russian government also engaged in a kind of bailout, except the money went straight to the oligarchs' companies. Well, that was fine. It placated the oligarchs for a while, but it's unlikely with oil prices where they are that the Russian government will continue to be able to bail out the oligarchs and other industries. And as a result, the agreement between the oligarchs and the Kremlin could break down. And if it does, you could see the oligarchs putting serious pressure on the Kremlin for policy changes or leadership changes. And so once again, you could see serious instability in Russia. And a Russian government, and perhaps this is a good thing for us, that is not as able to engage in the kind of sphere of influence building that we were watching this summer when they invaded Georgia, when they started doing military maneuvers and giving aid to Venezuela. They simply won't be able to afford it. So that may tame Russia, but it may also make it so that Russia, like China, is far less stable than it has been lately. And again, I should say, I'm not saying we're about to see governmental collapse in Russia and China, but we have to be very cognizant of the ability of those governments to continue to effectively govern.
So you've talked about the Russian government. You've talked about the oligarchs, who are the very wealthy corporate class, essentially. What about the ordinary people, the ordinary citizens of Russia? Where do they factor in politically and economically?
Well, unfortunately, they're essentially irrelevant politically and economically in terms of how Russia operates. In some ways, it is still fair to think of Russia as a first world country in Moscow and Petersburg with vast amounts of wealth and golden Rolexes and golden mobile phones. But when you get out to the provinces, with the exception of a few sort of oil boom towns, you're essentially still in a third world country with very low economic development levels. So those people will suffer. And in some ways, that brings us to a slightly different question, but it's what happens to those people in less developed countries, and the Russian ordinary citizen outside of Moscow and Petersburg certainly falls into that category.
Let's talk about that. As you said, people in developing countries, not first world countries, what happens in Africa, what happens in Latin America, where development is very much compromised when there's an economic downturn in first world countries?
Yeah, many of those countries are dependent on two major sources of revenue. The first is foreign aid, and the second is exports. And with respect to foreign aid, there will be a presumably, and in a moment we should perhaps talk about the President-elect Obama's goals in that regard, but there should probably be a foreign aid downturn around the world, with developed countries less able to provide foreign aid to assist, and also NGOs and other organizations that have characteristically stepped in where governments were unable to help their people, facing severe budget cuts. And so much less money flowing into countries that way. And secondly, with respect to exports, far fewer consumers. And even where there are consumers, when the global economy slows down, you often see a move toward toward protectionism, of states trying to increase tariffs, trying to get people to buy goods made at home. And while that might help Americans keep jobs, at least in the short term, it may well hurt the textile workers or the agricultural workers in developing states. So the pressure on those governments will be even greater, and the governments just don't have the resources or the capability to step in. It's one thing to think about the United States engaging in something that looks somewhat like the response to the Great Depression and the New Deal, but how can a government like Congo or Uganda or Vietnam engage in that kind of a policy? They just don't have the financial resources or the borrowing capability to do it. So I think you will see a significant downturn in what has been, at least for many people in developing countries, a slow rise in their standard of living. I think you'll see a downturn there, a lack of foreign aid to help them, and a situation where in some countries you see rising levels of hunger, malnutrition, and a very, very difficult situation for those people, perhaps much worse than what Americans might face.
We're talking to Bill Burke-White, professor of international law at the University of Pennsylvania. He's our foreign correspondent. What are Barack Obama's ideas about foreign aid? Does he think it's a good idea? Do we need more of it? Do we need less?
Well, President-elect Obama, when he was running for the presidency, indicated a desire to double U.S. foreign aid. The foreign aid budget, if you include some of the funds through the State Department, some through the Defense Department, and through the United States Agency for International Development, USAID, have run about $25 billion a year in recent years. And President-elect Obama has pledged to double that number to $50 billion. And it's a huge, hugely important move. The United States has fallen well behind, at least in per capita and income-based terms, other foreign aid donors such as the European Union, and partly as a piece of our goal of improving the U.S. image abroad, but also of having more influence abroad. President-elect Obama wanted to double that number. So on one hand, he has been very supportive of it and sees it as a central pillar of his new foreign policy. However, the problem is finding an extra $25 billion. Now, on one hand, that may not sound like a lot of money, given the size of the various bailouts that we've been talking about. It's the kind of money that's often hard to get congressional support for. It's easy to get Congress, or not easy, but doable to get Congress to support a bailout for the auto industry or the financial industry or to bring pork barrel politics home to their districts. But very few voters benefit from an increase in foreign aid, at least directly in the short term. And so finding the political ability to increase foreign aid budgets that much will be very challenging. So while it's a critical pillar of his foreign policy, whether he can deliver on it remains to be seen.
We haven't yet talked about Europe or India. Now, India, there's been a major terrorist attack in Mumbai recently. What was that all about, and how does the economic situation figure into that, if it does?
It does in part. If you look at the actual attack of last week in Mumbai, it was driven by a Pakistani-led militant terrorist organization. It was obviously not backed by the Pakistani government, and the Pakistani government has condemned it. But the organization was a political one and one opposed to India. And in many ways, it was a political terrorist attack driven by the political problems that we know of between India and Pakistan and the situation in Kashmir. And we could just write it off and say it was solely political. But I think it does factor in to the economic picture that we're talking about. There have been some uprisings in India. Last week there were some riots in which people were shouting and chanting death to Pakistan. And you see in many countries at the moment people who are angry. They may be angry at their government or angry at the economy. And if you just look around the world in the last 2 weeks, you've seen protests in Thailand against a corrupt government that closed both major airports for a week. You've seen protests in India, in England, in Greece. You have lots of unhappy people, and unhappy people who may be facing economic difficulties get angry, have less invested in keeping things calm and the status quo. And so because of that underlying economic difficulties, I think you're more likely to see conflict escalate when driven by a kind of unhappy population. And so there is a danger of that in India, and also a danger of, you know, a continued economic decline in both India and Pakistan that have far more people than they have jobs for in a slowing economy. And again, like in Russia and China, a chance of real unrest. So while this particular attack may not have been economically driven, it's the kind of flashpoint, like the shooting in Greece of the 15-year-old boy by the police, that can swell out of control and beyond the ability of the government to constrain far more easily when people are facing economic difficulties than when things are rosy and cheery.
So let's, before we go, turn to Europe. There's also economic woes there, as there are here. What does that mean for foreign policy? First of all, what does it mean to Europe? Are they facing the same kind of economic recession that we are?
Well, I'm actually speaking to you today from Germany, and the worries about recession here are in many ways just as great as they are in the United States. The interrelationship of the banking and credit worlds means that European businesses have been hit hard too, and that European governments are facing new budget constraints. So in that sense, Europe is suffering every bit as much as the United States. In terms of foreign affairs and foreign policy, I think it has two important ramifications for us in the United States. The first is that while the United States has focused on its military capability as its major tool of foreign policy throughout the last 8 years, Europe has focused on softer forms of power, foreign aid, development, deep connections with countries in the developing world. And Europe may be far less able to provide that kind of aid and assistance if it's facing the kind of financial difficulties we have here at the moment. And for the United States, that's problematic because we have sort of taken the approach of we'll go in and invade and throw out the bad guys and leave it to the Europeans to rebuild. Well, the Europeans may not have the ability and financial wherewithal to do that going forward. So we can't necessarily rely on them to provide that soft power. And that's part of the reason that Obama wants to strengthen America's soft power approach through a greater foreign aid budget. The second piece, however, with respect to Europe, is that many countries in the developing world have come to depend very heavily on very well-targeted foreign aid from Europe. And as that foreign aid perhaps dries up or gets cut back, it simply exacerbates the problem and creates a downward spiral where countries throughout the developing world are facing declining foreign aid budgets at the same time as loss of revenue streams from other sources. So both in terms of the overall foreign aid picture and the U.S. ability to depend on Europe or ask Europe to help with soft power, we're going to face a perhaps less able partner. Europe as a partner may be more willing to work with Obama than it was with Bush, but it may simply not have the financial ability to do so. And then there are a few outlier states in Europe like Iceland that had such serious financial collapses that you know, the very state was in danger of collapsing. I think that will be relatively limited, but with at least some European states, that's a real possibility.
Bill Birkwhite, we've got just about a minute left. Anything you would like to add before we go?
Yeah, I think that, you know, as we look forward, it is very easy to focus on our domestic needs, and there's every reason to think we ought to be spending money making sure that the car industry doesn't completely collapse and dealing with the domestic bailout. But what I hope your listeners recognize from our conversation tonight is that we need to put a lot of pressure on the government to push forward with foreign aid. It's not just because we care, which I hope we do, about people in the developing world, but America's very security depends upon stability in those countries. Look at what's going on in, say, Somalia, where there's no government and massive piracy on the high seas. So keeping the pressure on the new government, obviously the Obama administration is in support, but it's going to need support from Congress to keep the foreign aid budget up and to really think about how to effectively use soft power as we hopefully move away from the militaristic power of the Bush administration.
Bill Burke-White is professor of international law at the University of Pennsylvania, and he's with us about once a month talking about foreign policy. Thank you so much for being with us on the telephone from Germany.
It's a pleasure, and I wish you all a good day.
You too. You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR streams live on the web at ksfr.org. You can email me at radiocafe@ksfr.org or leave a message at 428-1528. We are podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show whenever you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services, and you can subscribe to the show on iTunes. Thanks to Marilyn LeBlanc for engineering today. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team, and after that, the colors of jazz. We will see you tomorrow. Have a wonderful day. Ciao.